Hey, this is Paul Anderson, and for those of you listening online, just want to give you a little bit of a picture of what was happening in the sermon today so it would make a little bit more sense to you as you're listening. At the beginning of the sermon, I start talking about all the junk in our lives, all the guilt and the shame and the pain and the things that we carry with us. And at that point in the sermon, you're going to hear some noises in the background. That's because we had volunteers coming up during that part of the sermon, and they're carrying junk to the front of the auditorium and dropping it in a big pile right in front of me. And that happens to the first quarter to third of the sermon until there's just this huge pile of junk sitting in front of me. And then at a turning point in the sermon, towards the end, when I start talking about forgetting what is behind and pressing on to what's ahead, they all come forward and they start moving the junk pieces until they've remade it into something else, into a communion table. And then at the very end, someone came in and set the elements, the cup and the bread, on top of this table, this table made out of junk. And it's a picture of what's happening in the sermon. So hopefully that'll make some sense to you. Thanks for listening.
So in the 1750s, by that time, both the Portuguese and the Spanish had taken a foothold in South America, right? Colonialism. And the Portuguese had actually sent Jesuit priests to South America to save the Indians. And the Spanish had sent mercenaries there to capture the Indians and sell them in the slave trade. And so in the 1980s, there was a movie came out that was set in this historical setting based on these historical facts. And it's a Robert De Niro film called The Mission. Some of you may have seen it. And in it, De Niro, classic De Niro, he plays this mercenary who is just ruthless. Like he literally, you see him at the beginning of the movie, he's heartless. He goes in and he's killing and capturing and just dehumanizing these Indians. And one day, though, he comes home, and it's just another day home from work. He's captured a bunch more Indians that he's going to sell off, and he comes home, and he finds his brother, his younger brother that he dearly loves, and he finds him in bed with his woman. And he flies off the handle, and he just completely loses it, and he actually turns and murders the one person in the world that he truly loved. And at that point in the movie, you see, like, just De Niro loses it. He completely breaks down, like, this guilt and the shame and all the stuff he no longer wants to live. And he completely isolates himself. And it's in that point that Jeremy Irons, the Jesuit priest, shows up and comes to him. And he wants to help him. He wants to reach him with the gospel. But when he gets there, it becomes apparent that De Niro does not want to be forgiven. He wants to pay for his own sins. So the priest says this. He says this to him. Okay, fine. You want to pay for your sins. Well, then are you man enough to do this? Do you dare to decide what it should cost you? And the next scene is a scene that always kind of wrecks me. It's Robert De Niro. You see him, he's with the priest and they're traveling up into the jungles and he is following them. He's going to go with them to serve the very Indians that he had murdered and captured and sold. But it's not just that. Behind him, he's dragging something. What, you know what he had decided his punishment should be? He decided that he should take all of his armor and all of his weapons and all of the things that represented his past and his violence and his sin, and he should bundle it up and he should have to drag it behind him indefinitely. And so you see him with this massive weight trying to travel up these cliffs and through this jungle, and he's slipping and he's stumbling and he's falling, and the weight is way too great for him, and the rope is just, coarse rope is tearing apart at his neck. And you see him falling under the weight again and again. One of the priests actually stops and says, God is not asking you to do this. You can let it go. But he can't let it go. One priest actually gets so mad at this, so like, this is so insane, that he takes a knife and chops it off of De Niro. But you know what De Niro does? He goes back down, picks it up, reties it around his own neck. Like, he can't let it go. He won't give it up. He is absolutely committed to punishing himself, and he feels he must drag this behind him until every last sin is paid for. Can you feel that? I can feel that. Like, I've never actually tied up a bunch of armor things, but I feel like I've drug around past sins before. I know this is terrible theology, and I know I can't carry my own sins, and I know I can't pay my own debt, and I know that God is not asking me to do this, but there's something in me that doesn't want to give up. There's something in me that wants to pay for my own sins. There's something in me that wants to do that. And one of the things I've learned after 4 years of being a pastor is that it's not just me and Robert De Niro. This club is a lot more inclusive than I once might have thought. That the fact of the matter is that I have seen some junk in my 4 years. Sexual addiction, cocaine, adultery, uncontrollable anger, unsolvable marital problems, paralyzing doubt, depression, eating disorders, self-abuse, self-pity, self-hatred, pain so deep that words fail, sexual abuse, broken marriages, estranged children, dads who abandon, and suicide. I've seen some junk. You know where I got that list? You, like sitting right here, right now, like in this room, in this congregation, every one of those things that I listed out, they're right here this morning, and those are the only the ones that I personally know about. If you can look to your right and look to your left, you will see hurt and addiction and brokenness, things that we can't forgive. You're going to see sadness and loneliness. You're going to see brokenness and guilt. You're going to see shame. You're going to see people who've done things that they can't take back, and you're going to see junk. Can you see it? Can you see? If we had eyes to see all the junk that we brought in right now, what would you be carrying? What would it look like for you? You know, the problem is not that we all have junk that we're carrying behind us. Jesus actually specializes in people with junk. I mean, you read through the scriptures, Jesus delights to take a liar, a cheat, an addict, a murderer, a racist, a gossip, wounded, broken people. He delights to take them and to make him disciples. You know what the problem is? How do we handle our junk? Repressing, hiding, denying, lashing out, and escaping. These are our normal mode in our church. And let me just ask you a question. How's that working for you? Today I want to pick up in Philippians chapter 3 where we left off. And we're just going to ask Paul, okay, if I believe that Jesus saved me, if I believe I'm saved by grace alone, that I'm forgiven, if I accept what he did on the cross for me, what now am I supposed to do with all this junk? And we're going to be in Philippians chapter 3, starting in verse 12. And in some ways, I just want you to hear this and listen to this carefully. I need you to think like adults today. Like, when we first come to this passage, it's really going to feel like, in some ways, exactly what not to say in a counseling session. Okay, I want you to imagine you take all your problems, all the things that have been done to you, all the things you've done, all your junk, and you were to lay it out for the Apostle Paul and say, Paul, here's my story, here's my wounds, here's my hurt. And it sounds like, in a superficial way, if you sit down, it sounds like you come to him and you know what he says to you? You need to forget it and press on. Like, what would you do if someone told you that? Thanks. Oh, great. I never just tried the let's just forget about it method. That's perfect. If we're not careful, we can turn this passage into some trite Christianese message that doesn't meet us where we're at all, that doesn't help in any way. We need to push through this, and we need to give some serious adult thought to this. We need to think about it at least as hard as you think about your finances, at least as hard as you think about remodeling your bathroom, okay? All right, watch this. Philippians chapter 3, verse 12. Not that I have already obtained all this or have already been made perfect. Okay, what's Paul talking about here? You haven't obtained what, Paul? And the answer is resurrection. Thank you. I'm Somebody's paying attention. Let's see. This, if you go back one verse, this is chapter 3, verse 11. It says, I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of sharing in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. So somehow, to attain to the resurrection from the dead. Paul says, I hope to attain that. Like, that's what I want. I want resurrection from the dead, but I haven't got there yet. And so we say, great, Paul, I hope to go to heaven too. And what in the world does this have to do with right now, though? And what Paul's going to say is that the point of resurrection isn't just hope in the afterlife. That the point of resurrection is hope right now. That it's Jesus' resurrection that allows him to press on in the midst of his junk. That the power of resurrection isn't just that someday you will die and then be resurrected. You'll be given a new body and a new world and a new life, although that's true. But the hope of resurrection is this. It's the same power that let the deaf hear, that made the blind see, that made the leper clean. It's the same power that turned the prostitute into a disciple. It's the same power that calmed the storm. It's the same power that can overcome my addiction and my lust and my fear and my guilt and my shame and my junk. Paul is saying something that is really important for us to hear. I want you to hear this. He's saying, I'm not there yet. That's what I really want. But I'm still struggling. I haven't obtained that. I'm still struggling with sin. I'm still being changed. I'm still feeling all the same things that you're feeling. I'm still longing for more. I'm not there yet. And this is Christianity 101. None of us are resurrected. So here's where Christianity, one of the major premises of Christianity is this. We live in a fallen world. There is sin everywhere. It's not just sin in us and not just like sinful things, but the whole world is tainted under the influence of sin. We live in a world that is not the way that it's supposed to be. So sin is not just out there, but sin is in here, Romans chapter 7. And the fact of the matter is that sin, it touches everyone. None of us gets a pass on it. So what's Romans 3 say? It says this, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. In fact, the news is going to get even better. The Apostle Paul wants us to know that as long as you're breathing, chances are you're going to be struggling with sin. And as long as you spend time with other people, chances are they're going to be sinning against you. Now, isn't that encouraging? Nowhere in Scripture does God promise to take away all of our struggle and all of our pain and all of our junk. Nowhere. You know what he promises? Matthew 28:20. I am with you always. You know what he promises? Hebrews 13:5. I will never leave you or forsake you. He says, if you'll hold on, if you'll trust me, If you'll hold this intention, I'm coming back and I will fix everything and I will resurrect you and I will make everything right. But you got to trust me. That somehow he's going to make everything right. That somehow what happened in Jesus Christ, that a dead, mangled Messiah came to life, somehow that is going to be applied to everything. Everything. Not just you and me, but everything. That somehow, listen to this, things that are hopelessly broken are going to be made whole. Things that are irreversibly damaged are going to be reversed. Things that are wrong will be made right. Death will be made alive. So how do you fix abuse? How do you solve an unsolvable marital problem? How do you undo what happened to you? How do you undo what you did in life? I don't know. But somehow, the same thing that happened to Jesus Christ is going to happen to you and to your relationships and to your hurt and to your pain and to your junk. The Christian hope is not a hope that we could somehow get rid of all the junk in this life. The Christian hope is that out of all of this junk, out of our broken, sinful people, God is making something new. Not that I've already obtained all this, or already been made perfect, but I press on to take hold of that for which Christ Jesus took hold of me. Brothers, I do not consider myself yet to have taken hold of it, but one thing I do, forgetting what is behind and straining toward what is ahead, I press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God called me heavenward in Christ Jesus. So, after service, we're going to preach, we're going to have communion, we're going to sing a couple songs, and then you're going to go out there. You're going to get a big plate, you're going to load it up with some pizza, and we got cake, and you get a cup. And you're going to go stand on the side, or you're going to go find a seat, and you know what's going to happen? Like that guy's going to come up to you, and you know that guy. Like you've talked to him a dozen times. And like you know he works there, and you know that's his wife, and he's got those two kids, and you know all that stuff, and you know him. But as soon as he comes up to you, what's going to happen? You're going to blank. He's going to say hi, and you're like, hi, you? How are you? You have no idea what his name is. Now, when we say forgetting, that's what we mean by forgetting, right? I mean, I cannot mentally recall this at this point, but we know when we read this, we know the Apostle Paul cannot mean that when he says forgetting, can he? You know how I know that? I've read chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. And what's it all about? His past. Look back, starting in verse 4, it says this. If anyone else thinks he has reason to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. And what's he give? He gives a list of seven things. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, the Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law of Pharisee, as for zeal persecuting the church, as for legalistic righteousness, faultless. This doesn't look like forgetting to me. Like, this is something, but this is a well-thought-out list of his past. In fact, if you go through this list, he's not only remembering it, he's taking the time to organize his past and think about it in such a way that he puts it in a list of seven chronologically and theologically escalating points. Can you do that with your past? Like, this is not forgetting in the way that we would normally mean. If you look at the list, if we go back here, we see that he actually takes the time to organize it. The first part is all about his heritage, right? He goes through, these are all the things that are true of me from my birth. And then the last three things, these are all things that I did, my achievements, when you look through it. And as you go through the list, he's taking the time to list out, dredge up everything from his past, the good things, the awards, the successes, the titles. But notice number 6, he actually takes the time in the church to say, now I want you to also know that as for zeal, I persecuted the church. You know what that is, right? Like he was personally responsible for the execution of Christians. Okay, I'm guessing that people in here, I'm not guessing, I know some people in here have some dark things in their past. But can you imagine? I think you're talking to the Apostle Paul and like, say, just tell me about yourself. Tell me a little bit about your past. And he's like, yeah, have you ever heard of that guy Stephen? And you're like, yes, Stephen, he's got a whole chapter in the Bible. It's awesome. What kind of, actually, he seems to ramble. He's got that speech that you're just like, come on, kill him already. And, but he goes on, if you've read in the book of Acts, you know what I'm talking about. He goes through all of the history of the Old Testament people. But at the end of that, the Apostle Paul's like, yeah, you know, I was there. And you're like, you were there, you know him. He says, yeah, I was personally responsible for overseeing his execution. And Paul somehow thinks that this is the type of thing that he should share with people. Paul seems to think that this is exactly the type of thing that he needs to share. In fact, when you go to 1 Timothy chapter 1, Timothy's this guy that worked with him for years, and he's in this church in Ephesus, and Paul says, he sends him a letter to say, hey, I want to help you as a church, and in that, as a church planter, as an elder of that church, I want you to be there, and there's a few things that you just need to share with the whole church that everyone in the church needs to meditate on. He calls them trustworthy sayings. Have you heard these before? So he says in 1 Timothy 5, here's a trustworthy saying that deserves full acceptance. Like, everyone in the church should memorize this, meditate on it, think about it. And there's two things I really want you to meditate on. You ready for them? Number one, Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners. And number two, of whom I am the worst. Like, if you want to understand the grace and power of God, you need to understand two things. One, Jesus Christ saved sinner. And two, I want you to meditate on how bad of a person I am. The Apostle Paul wants us to meditate on this fact. Okay, now let's set this aside for a minute and let's think. Whatever the apostle's doing here, whatever he's doing back in Philippians, this is not forgetting. This is not what we would usually call forgetting. So this begs the question, what does Paul mean? If he doesn't mean that we completely forget, we can't recall our past anymore, what does he mean in Philippians chapter 3 when he says, forgetting what is behind? And I think the clue is right here in verse 15. He says, all of us who are mature should take such a view of things. And if on some point you think differently, that too will God will make clear to you. Only let us live up to what we have already attained. We talked about this a few weeks ago. There's a word in here that you can't see it in the English, but there's two words that I want to point out to you. It's the word view, that all who are mature should take such a view of things. And it's if on some point you think differently, both of those words are actually the same Greek word. It's phroneo. We talked about this in chapter 2, verse 5. We talked about how you should have, in your relationship with one another, you should have the same phroneo, the same mindset of Jesus Christ, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. And we said, the Apostle Paul loves this word phroneo. Like, in the book of Philippians, it's not that common of a word. Jesus uses it once in all of his teaching. The Apostle Paul will use this in the book of Philippians 10 times. Like, this is the heartbeat of this book. Phroneo, 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 phroneo. And he's going to beat this drum a couple more times in verse 15. Look at this. He says, all of us who are mature should take such a phroneo of things, a mindset, a way of viewing things. And if on some point you phroneo differently, that too God will show you. The phroneo is a mindset. It's a way of thinking. It's a lens through which you view the world. It's the way that you think and feel and act and process everything that comes through you. Okay, so we all know this intuitively. We just don't usually spiritualize it and call it phroneo. So we've all met the guy, the single guy, he's 20-something, he's living on his own, he plays Xbox most of the day, he's passionate about sports and yings and wings, and he thinks turning his t-shirt inside out is better than doing laundry. Like, we've met the guy, right? But then what happens? Enter the girl. And next, what's he doing? Like, he's doing his laundry, he's wearing collared shirts, he's eating salads, he's using forks and knives, he's watching, you know, HGTV. And what happens? His buddies call him up one day. They're like, come on, man. We're going to the pub and we're watching the game tonight. It's the game. He's like, oh, I would like to, but I'm going to be antique shopping. And they're like, antique what? Now, here's the thing. At that moment in that relationship, because this new girl entered his life, the craziest thing is this. He really rather be antique shopping with her than watching the game with them. Now, what happened? I mean, what is this? Something deep in him has changed. Like, his values, they're inverted. What he once felt was a loss is now a gain. Sound familiar? So me, personally, up until my mid-20s, I did not like babies. And that's really hard as a pastor because everyone wants you to like their baby. Like they're squishy and squirmy and they, you know, things come out both ends all the time and unpredictably. And it's just like, yeah. And so people come up and be like, oh, you want to hold my baby? And I'm like, oh no. And so holding these babies. And then my wife got pregnant and her stomach started growing and we saw the sonogram and we start going to the little shopping. I get to carry the little thing and register for the little pink booties and stuff. And next thing you know, what happens as things shift in her stomach, things shifted in my heart and I'm like, pink booties. And I'm like picking out toys and I'm singing along to Dora the Explorer songs. I'm on all fours just speaking gibberish. And what happened to me? Like, what is this? Was this some type of game plan? Like, oh, this is what you need to think and feel. No, what happened was is she entered my life and it just wrecked me. It changed me. So getting married, becoming a parent, it doesn't just change what you do. It changes your phroneo. It changes your perspective. It changes how you view the world, how you process things, how you feel about things. It takes your gains and makes them losses. It changes what you value in life. And this is what the Apostle Paul is talking about here. Has the guy forgotten that he really loves sports and wings and not doing laundry? No, he hasn't forgotten that. But what's happened is it's been eclipsed by a new love. Have I forgotten that babies are squishy and splurt things out everywhere? No, I haven't forgotten that. But the reality, that reality is swallowed up in the new reality of parenthood. It's a whole new way of thinking, feeling, seeing the world. And the Apostle Paul, he looks at the Philippians and he says, that's it. Like, that's what happened to me, phroneo, like that type of thing. And if you're mature, if you spend time with Jesus Christ, that's going to happen to you too. Like, the more time you spend with him, as you walk with him, it's going to change the way you think and feel and process everything. Your gains are going to become losses. It's going to turn things upside down in you. Suddenly things that you hated to do, you're going to love. Suddenly you're going to feel different things. Suddenly you're going to think differently. Suddenly you're going to view the world differently. In fact, this change is so radical that he's going to call it forgetting. Now, has he forgotten that he's a murderer? Has he forgotten what he did in his past? No, not technically. But the guilt, the shame, the pain, the weight, that burden that he was dragging behind him, you know what? It's now eclipsed. It's swallowed up by something greater. A man named Jesus. It's swallowed up by grace. The shift is so fundamental that the very worst thing that he had done, murder, the very things that he once would have dragged behind him, the very things that he once would have hidden and denied and repressed and tried to cover up, those are the very things that he's now exposing. He's actually sharing with us so that we can see how immense and how healing and how amazing the grace of God is. So here's my question. What would it be like if your worst mistakes, your places of deepest hurt, your greatest guilt and shame, the things that you can't take back but you wish you could, what if somehow in Jesus Christ, those could be taken and reworked and moved and shifted so that the things that were once so awful now become the very thing where you meet Jesus Christ? What if the power of those things was broken, that you no longer felt like you had to hide or ignore or pretend? That you could actually ask other people to meditate on how sinful you are so that they could see how patient and gracious and amazing Jesus is. What if God wanted to do this for you? What if God wanted to take your junk and remake it into something new? Paul is saying this. I want you to think and feel and see your past in a new way, a way that is shaped by what you know God is doing in the resurrection of Jesus. That forgetting what is behind, not that you've completely pushed it out of your mind, but that you now think about it in such a radically different way that you know, that you know, that you know that God is going to make it something new and you can press on because you know it doesn't have power over you. But God is using it, and he wants to bless the world through you. All the junk in our life doesn't actually go away, does it? Something better happens. It's transformed. It's resurrected. That every sin and every selfish act and every doubt and every wound and every lie and every moment of loneliness and every bitterness and every bit of shame and every piece of junk, that Jesus wants it all. That all of my sin and all of my righteousness and all of my junk, he wants to take it and he wants to rebuild it into an altar, a place where we can meet him. That he wants to take your guilt and your shame and your brokenness. He wants to take liars and adulterers and people who hate themselves and murderers, and he wants to rebuild them into something beautiful for his name's sake. The end of the Christian life is not getting rid of all your junk. That's not going to happen. The end of the Christian life is this, is that we give all of our junk to him and he rebuilds it into something new. It's meeting him in your pain. It's holding it in surrender. It's pressing on. I've spent the last couple months getting into stuff that is chilling. And I know that there are people in this room and people who didn't make it today who are dying under guilt and shame and things they can't fix. I don't know what you're bringing in today. And I can't let go of it for you. And it's probably never going away. All I can do is say that you don't have to carry it alone. Jesus promises he will be with you. And he wants to meet you right here. Like, this is not just communion. This is not just bread. This is the promise that his body was broken for you. And whatever you might think about all your stuff and how God views you, that's proof that he was willing to die for you. And that's not just a cup. It's the promise that his blood was shed for the remission of your sins. That all that junk you think is yours is his, because he actually paid for it with his life and his blood. And I don't know how he's going to fix it. And I honestly don't know how he can fix these things, but I know this, he's promised that somehow, in the same way that Jesus rose from the dead, everything will be made new.